Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
Hey everybody, you want to know what we found in the Vault Conspiracy? Quickly before they catch up to me, there's a fascinating podcast that I need to tell you about before they catch up to me. It's called Conspiracy Unlimited, hosted by Richard Syrett. If you enjoy mind-blowing mysteries, little-known facts, true crime stories, alternate history, and the paranormal, you'll want to check out this podcast quickly. The website is conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. That's conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Here they come. Run, everybody. Go.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery on KFNX Phoenix, 1100 AM. I'm your host, Al Warren. Now, my special guest co-host is from The Buzz on Z-Talk Radio Network, Kev Thompson.
Hey, thanks for having me on board, Al.
Well, I'm glad you're here, Kev. We've got another great show. We thought Kennedy was big. Now we've got someone even bigger, believe it or not. Now, he's the co-creator of Deadly Sins on ID Channel. He's the co-host of Did He Do It, also on the ID Channel. And he's the criminal interventionists on Breaking Point, again on the ID Channel. I'm beginning to think maybe he owns the channel. And now, if that ain't enough, he's also the founder of the Cabanoki Law Firm, and he's known as an award-winning criminal defense attorney. He's been named one of the top 100 trial lawyers in California every year since 2007. So we're more than pleased to welcome to the show Darren Cabanoki.
Thank you guys for having me. It's really, it's a delight to be here.
Well, thank you for being here. You're a really, really busy person. And I was going to start with that. I mean, with three shows, you've got the blog, you've got the law firm, a book club. When do you ever have time to just take a break?
I got a lot of plates that I keep spinning, and thankfully I've got a lot of people that that help me do what it is that I do. I could never accomplish the volume of material that we're able to get done. But I wish I could do more with Investigation Discovery. Sadly, I don't own the network, but if I did, I would have given myself a raise long ago. But it's been just such a joy being able to contribute to people at that level. I think television, and now, of course, with YouTube and podcasting and all the various vehicles that there are to reach people, it's amazing how much more leverage people have to be able to carry a message. And it's just such a delight to be able to tap into that niche following at Investigation Discovery. I love it. We're in our fifth season now on Deadly Sins. As a matter of fact, this Thursday night is our double episode finale of the new season of Deadly Sins, and I'm really excited. And for those who love a two-screen experience, I'm always live tweeting during the airing of a new episode or any episode that I can catch wind of and I'm awake for. I love to stay very engaged with ID addicts and people that love the crime genre. So if you want to tweet with me during those shows or anytime, I'm at Darren Cabanoki. You know, just the common spelling.
You mean there is a common spelling to a name like Cabanoki?
Deadly Sins has been phenomenal for five seasons now. It's funny how quickly time passes. It seems like only yesterday we shot our first episode in a freezing cold church in New York City. And of course, Did He Do It? I think our claim to fame there is one of the episodes that we dealt with there was the Stephen Avery case, which, of course, came to national prominence, maybe even global prominence, with the Netflix series Making of Murderer. And yes. I think I can safely say we did it first, so obviously they were derivative of whatever groundbreaking journalism we were doing. But for fans of crime, specifically in true crime stories, I think the Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey cases are amazing. If for nothing else than the proposition that being able to actually see and judge things with our own eyes gives us a very different view than what the headlines often do. But by that I mean when we were doing the Stephen Avery case on Did He Do It, there was certain information that we were given about the case, and I'd studied up and read about the case. And I was aware of the Brendan Dassey, and now I'm using air quotes, the Brendan Dassey confession, such as it was. and the headlines were best probably illustrated by the prosecutor in that case, who did that one press conference where he said, hey, take the kids from the room. If there's any children in the room, cover their ears and take them out of the room, because now I'm going to share with you the horrific detail of this case. And what you thought you learned was that Brendan Dassey had confessed to some really horrific aspects of this crime, that the victim was tied down to the bed and stabbed multiple times and raped multiple times, et cetera, et cetera. Except the only problem was that there was no physical evidence to correspond to it. There was no DNA evidence to suggest that there would be blood anywhere in the vicinity where Brendan Dassey articulated that there was. And, of course, when you start digging into who this kid is, he is a young man with an IQ of 70, which is borderline retardation, and when you actually see the videotaped confession, instead of just the headline of Brendan Dassey confesses, what you see instead is police officers putting words into the mouth of a kid who just has no understanding or appreciation for what's going on, and who gives answers like, yes, 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 are you guys going to get me back to school for fifth period? In the meantime, they're getting ready to arrest him for murder. So anyway, it's amazing how different things are when we see the headline than when we view them with our own eyes.
Now, on a case like the Stephen Avery case, where it's been televised so much via the documentary, and then now it's like been on every news show and interviews and stuff, I take it that you're happy because it is something that's televised, that you do like cameras in the courtroom.
Oh, not only would you say I'm happy about it, but I think they should be standard issue in every courtroom. And it's pretty interesting how in each courtroom now, in the state courtroom system, in the state court system, the Los Angeles Superior Court or whatever your state court system may be called in your particular state, the discretion of whether or not to allow cameras in the courtroom lies with the trial judge. And we saw this, by the way, on the Jody Arias case. If you'll remember, the first case, everything, there were cameras in the courtroom, from beginning to end, and then Judge Sherry Stevens, had suffered so much public criticism for how she managed that trial that when the jury hung on the penalty phase and they were getting ready to go do round two, no cameras in the courtroom that time, right? Because she didn't, for a variety of reasons, but I think some of them were selfish in that she didn't want to look bad. In the federal, but that's an example of the state court system where every judge gets to decide for him or herself whether in a particular case there's going to be a camera in the court. In the federal court system, there is a blanket rule of never, absolutely never. And in the United States Supreme Court, there's audio recordings of the lawyers arguing the cases. Obviously, the opinions come down in the form of written opinions, but there's no cameras even in the United States Supreme Court. And for me, the problem I have with it is that it leaves people feeling a lack of confidence or feeling a lack of integrity in the justice system, both criminal and civil, frankly, although in the criminal justice system it becomes, I think, most egregious. And by the way, I know we mentioned the Jody Arias case, and there was cameras and non-cameras in the court there, but I think probably one of the most stark examples of this was another case that was covered extensively by HLN and CNN and many of the news outlets, and that was the George Zimmerman case, or in the killing of Trayvon Martin, where in that particular case, there was such I think, well, let me just speak plainly about it. I mean, such a lousy job done by the prosecution team in the preparation of their witnesses and the presentation of their evidence. And it for people who actually saw that case, and if you remember, this was a case that was very polarizing for racial issues and for other issues too, around guns and use of force and for a variety of issues, but certainly for race, and that was all the hoodie movement, and
still use that.
I'm sorry?
They still use that.
Oh yeah, oh very much so. I think it still speaks to people's deep-seated feelings about the justice system and transparency or lack thereof in the system. But my point is this, is that if you watched the trial, which you can only do if there's a camera in the court, if you saw and heard how poorly those prosecution witnesses fared when they were on the witness stand, both for the prosecution and under cross-examination from the defense. If you saw that with your own eyes, heard it with your own ears, regardless of how you felt about George Zimmerman or Trayvon Martin or where you came down on those issues, if you saw that case, you understood. At least you had an understanding of why it was that the jury reached exactly the result that they reached. Because I think that given the case that they were given, frankly, putting aside whatever political issues or personal issues arise from that fact pattern, I don't think the jury had much of a choice given how badly the prosecution botched it. And so I think the idea of cameras in the courtroom is by and large, sorry to give you such a long-winded answer to such a simple question, but the truth of the matter is I'm a huge proponent of cameras in the courtroom, and it's insane to me that there isn't a cry for more of it.
Yes, but when we have a high-profile case, like the O.J. Simpson case, for instance, and the prosecuting attorney, Marcia Clark, and you get nude pictures of her on the beach, now wouldn't that affect my performance as an attorney when I've got all this pressure, not only to try and convict a high-profile like O.J. Simpson, but I'm also being on every comedy show like Saturday Night Live, to every news broadcast, tabloid magazine, people loving me, hating me, making fun of me, my hair?
So I would say this, that, and it's funny, now that O.J. Simpson is back again with some of these shows that, you know, both the one, I think, I know there have been a couple of them. There's the ESPN 30 for 30 five-episode series, and then the one that I call the Bob Shapiro with too much makeup on series, but both of which I think were commercially very successful, and I think bring us back to the early days of cameras in the court and the public reaction to these cases. And I don't mean looking back in awe, isn't it cute, you know, look, gee, if it wasn't for those early days, you know, we wouldn't have Nancy Grace now. If you think about it, remember the early days of Court TV with Cochran and Grace and all the Greta Van Susteren and all the careers that were launched on the back of the O.J. Simpson case and TV coverage. I agree with you that O.J. Simpson probably stands as much for the proposition of here's an example of how to do it wrong versus here's how to do it right. But that said, just because there's one very public example of doing it wrong doesn't mean that we throw out the baby with the bathwater and don't do it. As a matter of fact, way back when, and it's funny because it's not on anymore, there was a network devoted to courtroom coverage called Court TV, which I think many, many people still recognize as a brand. And, you know, through the whys and wherefores of the television world, Court TV was inherited by True TV, all under the global umbrella of Turner Broadcasting. And then there was In Session, where they did basically 6 hours a day that was on HLN. And then, I don't know, some new boss came in and said, hey, let's get rid of this stuff. For whatever reason, you know, that's far above my pay grade. You know, that's the rarefied air where the suits get to work. But I think there was a great. I used to appear on Court TV as a guest expert. As a matter of fact, I hosted Court TV from time to time, or when it became In Session. As a matter of fact, I think I'm the answer to a Trivial Pursuit question, at least in my own mind, because I was the very last host of the very last episode of In Session, the successor to Court TV, and it was in the Jody Arias case. It was in the non-verdict, the hung jury verdict on the penalty phase in Jody Arias 1, and that was the very last episode of In Session, which I was proud and pleased to host. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And look, I may be a lousy focus group, because I was a guy that was going through law school loving my Court TV and watching LA Law, and I just couldn't get enough of this stuff. But I think it gives people a greater understanding of what's going on and what everybody's role is in the justice system. And, by the way, there's some of the most fascinating, compelling, bizarre, sometimes heartwarming stories that you'll ever hear. You know, the real-life drama that is that's told in our courtroom every day. I think it's a shame that Court TV isn't around in some form or fashion, or that something else really hasn't taken its place. Yeah. You know, HLN did a bit, but...
Yeah, I really liked having Court TV, and it kind of shows my age. Now it's been gone for a while. When we were talking about the Jody Arias case, I almost get the impression that the TV coverage almost ruined it, not only for the verdict, but you look at people like the defense attorney, Kirk Nurmi, and I mean, and that really... really was hard on him.
You mean Kirk Nurmi did because of his whatever, because of his...
Yeah, he had to be in hiding. He had death threats against him and his family. There was people that hated him because he was defending a murderer, and then there was people that hated him because they thought he was doing a bad job defending her.
Right.
And this is all for a case that he tried to get off three times, but the judge turned him down all three times. So he was a court-appointed attorney defense. So it was something he didn't even want to do. And it's not to say anything bad about him or about court-appointed attorneys, like the defense attorneys, when you get the free attorney that you get assigned. It's not saying anything bad about them or that they're a bad lawyer.
I would agree with that statement. Well, I would say it this way, that it's not necessarily true. That is that fundamentally, so there's the public defender system, which is basically like one large law office, and in many jurisdictions they'll have the public defender's office as a formal office. In some either smaller places or in some even larger places where they have co-defendant cases with some regularity, they'll also have a group of basically private lawyers, but who will get appointed by a judge to handle a particular case. And I think the problem really is this, number one, from the client's perspective, there's a feeling of lack of control. You know, that they're already into the system, here they are, they're indigent, and now they are being given a lawyer who there may be some fundamental mistrust for, just for no other reason than the fact that they're being given it, they're being given that lawyer by the same, you know, government who's trying to put him in jail in the first place, right? So there may be good reason to be suspicious in general if you put yourself in the client's shoes. But the system in so many respects, I think, is broken from the standpoint that there are, and I know them, you know, some of my best friends are public defenders, you know, some of my, I know some very good and dedicated, hardworking, ass-kicking public defenders. And then I know, and won't name names, but I know some really lazy public defenders. And the problem with the public defender's office, by and large, is that you've got a group of lawyers who get paid the same amount of money whether they're busting their ass or not, whether they're giving great customer service or not, or client service, whether they're very, whether they have great bedside manner or not. And I think that's a broken system. You know, there's something to be said for an entrepreneurial environment where the public gets to vote with their pocketbook. Because I know in my office, we spend a great deal of time with the lawyers in my firm, and you know, from the receptionist on down, and I mean that because it's a receptionist, and you know, the people that are picking up the phone and speaking to somebody in crisis, who are the first voice that the clients can hear, and it's important that it be a friendly voice. And it's not a judgmental voice, and it's a voice who's there for them and who isn't going to rush them and who really gets that they need to create a good experience, just like the lawyers that work with me are all get that they need to create that good experience, because we're in a business environment where, besides the fact that it's the right thing to do, it's good business. You know, it's good, and it's just being a good, decent human being. It's just how things should be done. And I think the problem with the public defender's system is it does call for people to be overworked, to handle caseloads sometimes that are beyond what a lawyer should reasonably handle in order to be competent, to do their job effectively. And I think, frankly, there are some, I mean, look, if you get paid the same amount of money to bust your ass or to do crossword puzzles, you may, on some days or many days or all the days, do crossword puzzles or the virtual equivalent of that, or the functional equivalent of that, I should say. You know, I see in many courtrooms that it's the court, not to throw any court clerks under the bus, because God knows I love them and couldn't get my job done effectively without them. But somebody, maybe it's the bailiff, maybe it's the court clerk, every morning they hand out the crossword puzzle to the court staff. And all of the court staff all day long is working the same crossword puzzle, including the prosecutor and including the public defender. And they're all in the same courtroom getting chummy with each other, working that crossword puzzle, and maybe sometimes more energy needs to be put on fighting the good fight rather than solving 23 across. Or at least that's my take. You know, I think it's easy to lose cases, and it's easy, especially on the defense side, to find reasons where a client would be better off to settle a case rather than to fight. And it takes energy and effort and gumption and tactics and everything else to fight. But sometimes that's just what it is you got to do.
Well, Darren, let me ask you a question. I'd like to revisit the cameras in the courtroom if we could.
Mm. Sure.
I'm a big proponent of cameras in the courtroom as well, because I think that the public needs to see both sides and they need to see everything.
Yes.
Going back to the Trayvon Martin case, I mean, I would have come to the same conclusions as the jury did based on what I saw. Off air, me and Al were talking about, you know, you pretty much base your opinions on your perceptions and your perceptions according to what you see.
Yeah.
Would you be a proponent of the public seeing everything? Because we're only seeing bits and pieces. We're seeing little testimonies in the news. You know, they clip, they cut, they edit. And I really don't want to base my opinion based on an agenda that is set up by a media network.
You know, it's so funny because people, all of us who comprise the court of public opinion as opposed to a court of law, you know, we're all entitled to our opinions and we all have our opinions, and those opinions oftentimes are based on very limited information, right? I mean, I think that's what I hear you saying. Is that there are either snippets of information that are given, or there are either to further a particular agenda, there may be careful editing done rather than just let it all hang out.
Absolutely.
And I would say I would lean on the side of letting it all hang out, but I think that there's also room. And actually a requirement, really, for some commentary to go along with that. Not just in the sense of, hey, wait a second, what about the countervailing view, but to really, really explain, you know, it's been a long time for many people since they've had social studies class in high school or whatever it was where they learned about the court system. And until somebody has some connection to it, either as a defendant for their first traffic ticket, or they're called as a juror, or whatever it is, there really isn't. You know, it's one thing to study in the theoretical; it's another thing to see it and understand it and see it in action. And I think that's where commentators, you know, people like me, and there's lots of us that do this, can really do a great service by explaining what the role of the judge is, really, and what the role of the prosecutor is, and what that defense lawyer is doing, and what the tactics are that they may be employing, and why lawyers might choose to go sidebar. Oftentimes, people that are in the court of public opinion, people that are just out there in the world, they may even know evidence or some slice of material about the case that the jury doesn't even get to hear, because one of the functions of the judge is to decide what evidence is legally admissible and what isn't, or what evidence, because of some kind of public policy reason or because of established case law, may be logically relevant, but it may not be legally kosher, and keep that evidence out. And unless you've got somebody that can explain, hey, look, here's why the judge is making that call, and to do some analysis about that or explanation about that, then I think it oftentimes just leaves people wondering or feeling frustrated.
Yes. Well, here's something that's very, very frustrating, and you tell me from a defense attorney's point of view. Let me give you a real-life example.
Sure.
I work law enforcement, and I was providing court security on a murder case where the defendant was up on the stand. He was, you know, accused of capital murder. He was looking at the death penalty, and he begins on the stand to actually mock the victim's families.
Mm.
The judge turns to the jury and says the jury will disregard those statements. Now, Darren, the genie is out of the bottle.
Right.
And can you really depend on a jury to forget what they just heard when this man is on the stand and is looking at the victim's family saying, yeah, he cried when I shot him, and, don't worry, he may have had a good, career in basketball, but he really, sucked at it. How, as a jury, how can you expect a human to disregard statements like that and still get a fair trial? Now, this was done in front of the media. Did the media play this? No, they did not play the video, but they did report that he had done so. So I guess my question is really two-pronged. Would you expect a jury to actually forget those statements? Would it be fair? And also, is there a difference between video and or just reporting?
Well, first of all, I love the question, and I think it is asking way too much of a human being to wipe something from their memory banks. I mean, even notwithstanding somebody's best intentions to do so, it's an exercise that I think is it's folly. And it's almost crazy what we ask of our jurors. The system of jury selection, frankly, is more like jury deselection, where both sides are getting rid of the lawyers that they feel like are going to be horrible for them so that they can be left with, the ones that they can live with most of the time. That's the game that the lawyers are playing. And I think the idea that a judge can just, do the functional equivalent of waving a magic wand and saying, well, the jury is to disregard whatever those last statements may be. Juries aren't so great at doing that. And what's really insane is we take these legal concepts, which I studied for years in law school and still barely, if at all, understood. And I'm sure you studied for years as you were going through your law enforcement training. And we ask a bunch of jurors, first of all, we get rid of all the lawyers, because God forbid we want a lawyer on our jury. That's too powerful of a player back there in the jury room, really. That's why that happens. Unless I've seen it happen from time to time where two lawyers are left on a jury where they are the kinds of lawyers that are likely to disagree. I was on one case where we had a ponytail-wearing ACLU member and then one guy who was like this really buttoned-up corporate type. And we're like, oh, yeah, these two are never going to get along. And sure enough, the jury hung, and they were each on one side of the issue. And for us in that particular case, a hang was a win, as it is in any case for the defense where, anything other than a guilty verdict is a win. But I think we do a ridiculous thing where we take these jurors with no legal training, and if they have legal training, we bounce them, and then we put them back there in the jury room after saying things like, oh, disregard some statement that no human being could disregard. And then when they have questions about the law or the definition or what something means, maybe we'll bring them back out into court and we'll say, go read the jury instructions or reread instruction number 12.2 or whatever it is. And it's crazy that in the span of sometimes days, but oftentimes in just a few hours, occasionally weeks, there's no rules on how long jurors can stay out, the jury is going to sift through that material and reach a verdict or not. And I think in many respects, it's just unrealistic that we ask so much of that particular population that we've worked so hard not to empower. It's kind of crazy when you take a step back from it. And yet,
every time I hear that, I expect Will Smith to run out with a little memory wiper and flash it in everybody's eyes.
I bet it's true.
When we get into wrongful convictions and how you mentioned the Steve Avery case, and that's a perfect example. He was convicted of a crime that later he was proved that he didn't. The DNA proved he didn't. And yet the prosecution and the original sheriff and deputies on duty, you know, under oath, turn around and say, well, if you believe in DNA. So, you know, you have the law enforcement who knows DNA is accurate and real, kind of throwing out the, yeah, if you believe in it. And that's just because they don't want to let go, what, that they've made a mistake or they convicted someone wrong. I'm just not sure how to take that.
It's a fascinating subject, and I think it speaks in a way to that last question about how impossible it is for the human brain to disregard something, and it all relates to the functioning of the human brain, you know, that we believe our own lying eyes more than we may believe science about certain things. And what's striking to me is there are a couple of great resources that speak to this exact issue. Barry Scheck and the Innocence Project obviously has a website that speaks primarily to the exonerations that are driven by DNA, and there have been many, many hundreds of those. But the larger list is the one that's maintained by the Northwestern University Law School that has a clearinghouse of the exonerated. And the last time I looked at it, there have been something like 1,800 people that have now been exonerated from over 10,000 wrongfully served prison years, where in each one of those cases, every safeguard of the criminal justice system broke down. And by that, I include the law enforcement officers who are investigating cases. The law enforcement officers, their job basically is to investigate and write reports that memorialize their investigations and their findings, and then they present that to prosecutors who ultimately have the decision of whether and what charges to bring, and then they bring those charges and they put them in front of the jury after the defense lawyer makes proper objections so that the judge can rule on what is legally admissible and not admissible evidence. And in each one of those cases, of those 1,800 plus cases, every single aspect of that justice system just blew it. And it's mind-blowing to me how some people, as you say in the question, how they can ignore DNA just like, you know, if you believe in that sort of stuff, it's like, yeah, if you believe in that gravity kind of stuff. Like, yeah, I mean, there are some things are just beyond reasonable minds can differ. Like, well, okay, if you want to believe in gravity, then you're free to do that. But, you know, there are some things that are just beyond dispute. There are other things, frankly, that aren't. What's interesting is when you look at the population of people that are exonerated, DNA is a huge part of it. There's other reasons for false convictions. You know, wrongful eyewitness testimony is another huge contributing factor. And that's been proven through all kinds of psychological evaluations and stage happenings, that the human brain, once again, I think it boils down to us, that the human brain is just not designed to perceive and store and then recall events in the same way that a computer does. And even though we may have a high degree of confidence in the things that we're saying as being true based on, you know, observing something that's alleged to have occurred, a lot of times we just flat out get it wrong, even though we think we're right, to the point that we could pass a polygraph test about it. And there was very famously a case that was on 60 Minutes a woman who, I mean, it was horrible. She suffered a brutal attack and rape in her home, her apartment when she was in college, and she kept her wits about her, and she was painstaking and very brave that she was going to get her perpetrator into the kitchen where there was really good lighting so that she was going to be able to observe this individual and be able to give the police the best information possible. And she did that. And they came up with a sketch which looked just like she remembered the guy to look. And they ended up making an arrest. And this person served many, many years in prison. And this lady said she was up on the witness stand. It was absolutely 100% to a moral certainty. That was the guy. She had picked him out of a lineup. That was the guy. That was the guy. And in her brain, that was the guy. Only the DNA showed otherwise that it wasn't the guy. And the conflict then, you know, ultimately this guy was released. The conflict that this woman felt internally, knowing that as a result of her faulty identification, that not only had the wrong guy done all those years in prison, but the real bad guy was out where he had the opportunity to commit more crime. And the two of them, it was amazing because on this television piece, they were actually reunited, and the two of them go around the world speaking to audiences everywhere about the foibles, if you will, of eyewitness identification. There's a professor, Elizabeth Loftus, who used to be up in Washington, and now I think she's down at the UC Irvine Law School, has done an extensive amount of study in this area. You know, the human brain just does a lousy job. False confessions, those are my other ones. Those are some of my favorites. Because we all believe, how could we, you know, as you and I sit here in the comfort of our own rooms, you know, with our full bellies, having eaten lunch recently, and you know the comfort of freedom of movement, you know, we say things like, "Oh, I would never falsely confess to a crime that I didn't commit." Well, guess what, Bob? You know, we put you in a different set of circumstances. You have enough people wearing on you long enough. You're hungry enough, you believe if you just say this one thing, you go home, like the mind plays tricks, and people falsely confess to things they didn't do with shocking regularity.
Well, what is it we can do about something like that? And is there a fix for the system, and is it a large fix or just a fine-tuning, and especially with all these wrongful convictions?
Yeah, I think some of it. I think there is a fix in terms of everybody in the system bringing a higher level of integrity to the system. So that is not being satisfied with remarks like the jury will just disregard that comment, and being satisfied that that's going to be enough to fit the bill. But I think it really starts, truthfully, with being willing to have some very frank and difficult conversations. It's like, you know, until you're willing to acknowledge that something's broken, the chances of it actually being fixed are haphazard and not so good. If we're talking about something, the systemic problems of the justice system, Sadly, I think those conversations happen and then are soon passed over. You know, when there's a police shooting that captures the national or international attention, then it's talked about, and then it's unfortunate, but the news cycle then moves on, and it's the next tragic event that seems to get the coverage. And The other thing is throwing a problem or throwing money at something. I think we look at the criminal justice system as a necessary evil rather than a situation that we can work our way out of. And in the United States, we do a better job of imprisoning people than it seems like most other countries in the world. and there's something going on here that until and unless we're willing to have a frank conversation, it's going to be business as usual. You know, it's like it's that saying, you know, if you want to keep getting what you're getting, keep doing what you're doing, and if you want to get something different, you got to do something different. And
yes.
And yep. Until we're willing to do something different, then we're going to keep getting what we're getting.
But isn't the system, hasn't it gone a little too far? Isn't it too complicated for the average person to work around? I mean, everything that you need to do in the legal system, you need to get a lawyer. I mean, all the contracts, everything we do, we need to get legal advice. It's not something we can just go and do.
It is definitely a system that is not designed for the layperson. And frankly, it's even tough for novice lawyers to navigate through the system oftentimes. It's a very difficult system to navigate even amongst seasoned professionals. And unfortunately, for better or for worse, the rules of the game have been dictated by the Constitution. And that's the one thing that, although it's subject to interpretation, is set in stone. And as a result, if the prosecution has got the only burden of proof, and it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and that puts the defense in the business of creating or exploiting reasonable doubt wherever possible. And unless we're willing to have some kind of a fresh conversation where we put a premium on just telling the truth regardless of consequences or coming up with fair consequences that really match what's going on, then I think we're really doomed. And by that I'm thinking specifically about the world of addiction and the interplay of drugs and alcohol in the criminal justice system. Sadly, I see so much where drug addiction and crime go hand in hand, and yet we punish criminality and don't provide motivation for people to get help for the real underlying problem, which is the addiction issue driving the criminality in the first place. And so, like, unless we're willing to get real about that and say, hey, maybe instead of punishing this person, we need to treat the disease of addiction that's underlying it, you know, then we can really start to make some headway. But, you know, unless we're willing to have those frank and often difficult conversations, it's going to keep on keeping on.
Yeah. Well, 80% of my inmates right now are due to some type of a drug charge. But
wow. Stunning.
It is what it is. But, Darren, you brought up a point that I'd like to go back to.
Sure.
You mentioned throwing money at something. If I remember right, in your resume, Hulk Hogan is floating around back there.
Yeah, I did some commentary on the Hulkster and that particular case involving Gawker.
Well, would you say that his fame and his money would get him more, what's the words I'm looking for? Maybe a better defense than the average Joe on the street?
Interesting. I think somebody's status as a celebrity can work both for or against them. And so, for example, in the O.J. Simpson case, I think O.J.'s celebrity worked for him very much, and it was very much in his favor. I think Paris Hilton was an example of somebody's celebrity working against them. If you remember the Paris Hilton case from a few years back.
I
right?
do. What is she known for?
Well, that's a whole separate question. I think we need a whole other hour to try and dissect that, or maybe we only need 30 seconds to say,
no.
Famous remains famous, yeah.
Let me bring one more up for you that was an absolute shocker for me, because this is where Court TV actually did its job. I followed it very closely, and then I was devastated at the end. The Michael Jackson case.
And Conrad Murray.
Yes, I was sure, and I know we're running up against the clock here, but I was absolutely certain that Michael Jackson was guilty. And I watched Court TV, which, you know, leads us back to the cameras in the courtroom.
Yep.
And plus what the media was reporting, and it was looking very, very bad for him. And
right.
Then when they said not guilty, I was shocked, Darren. Hogan and Michael Jackson and OJ, let's tie them all together, and I'm interested to see what you have to say about that.
Well, I think ultimately, if somebody has celebrity, then they have certain advantages to level the playing field that an indigent person is not going to. So if you're a celebrity, you can hire great lawyers, you can get world-class experts, You can have investigators do the kind of defense investigation that's really needed. And I think the best example of that was, if you guys remember the Serial podcast series, Serial version 1 involving Adnan Syed and somebody else who now has been granted a new trial apparently, where Sarah Koenig and some of the producers are wondering aloud in one of the later episodes about whether they're parsing the evidence to finally about whether or not they're creating issues that really weren't there. And as a lawyer, my reaction to that was it wasn't that they were parsing the evidence too finely at all. It was that what passes for justice in many American courtrooms on a daily basis does not involve parsing the evidence finely enough. And I think that's where celebrity can be a factor where, hey, you got money to do that which needs to be done, then there's a much better chance that it's going to be done. What's interesting about the Hulk Hogan case is that was a case that, unlike these other ones that we've been talking about, which have all been criminal cases, in Hulk Hogan we're talking about a civil case where people are fighting about money, and there the lawyer's incentive is less about the Hulkster and his reputation or his celebrity or lack thereof, and it's more about whether or not the other side has deep enough pockets to pay off any award that they might be able to obtain. And of course, obviously, in this case, they obtained quite an award on behalf of Hulk, one that's been debated about whether or not it may be too much of a reward, but that's a whole other. But I think a lot of times lawyers that do contingency fee work take a bad rap, or they get a reputation unnecessarily so as chasing ambulances or what have you. The truth of the matter is that there are many, many people, especially folks that are indigent, who suffer some kind of injury or some kind of wrong, and until and unless there's a lawyer who's willing to take the case on a contingency, that wrong would go without any kind of redress whatsoever.
This has just been a fascinating hour, but we are running out of time.
Oh, time flies when you're having fun.
It's just a fascinating field, true crime. I mean, we could just go all day.
Well, it's been great chatting with you guys, and if we want to continue to a part two sometime, then you have a welcome guest in me. I would love to come back and join you guys. It's been great talking to smart people about interesting stuff.
Again, our guest has been the accomplished trial lawyer, David Cavanocchi, and he's the co-creator and host of Deadly Sins, co-host of Did He Do It, and the criminal interventionist on Breaking Point, all on the Investigation Discovery Channel. Thanks for listening, everybody, and thanks again for my co-host, Kev Thompson.
All right, guys. Take care, everybody.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well,
Good night.
This has been a production of the Z-Talk Radio Network.
I'll be back.